The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
I was pleased to see he reached a firm conclusion that no charges should be brought against me in this case. This was an exhaustive investigation going back more than 40 years.
Special Counsel Robert Hur did not charge President Joe Biden after finding he knowingly stored and disclosed classified documents in unsecured locations at his homes in Virginia and Delaware, concluding that the evidence did not establish Biden's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the 400-page report had stopped with those legal conclusions, it probably would have been the end of the matter. But the special counsel included what many Democrats see as gratuitous swipes at Biden's memory, in particular saying, quote, "We have also considered that at trial, Mr. Biden would likely present himself to a jury as he did during our interview of him, as a sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with a poor memory."
My memory, take a look at what I've done since I've become president. None of you thought I could pass any of the things I got passed. How'd that happen?
Of course, former President Donald Trump is facing criminal charges for his mishandling of classified documents, and he called for the charges against him to be dropped as well.
If Biden is not going to be charged, he said, that's up to them. You know, look, if he's not going to be charged, that's up to them. But then I should not be charged.
My guest is national security expert Brad Moss, a partner at Mark Zaid. So, Brad, did Biden have classified documents about the Afghanistan war? Is that basically it? And what classified rankings did they have?
So the records that, as far as we understand, were found could certainly have implicated some very sensitive information in terms of U.S. government defense policy and troop strategy, things along those lines. And as far as we can tell, at least some of the records that were found between the Biden house and then in the different facilities were classified up to top secret. So it's not as if this was not legitimately sensitive classified information. They never should have been any of those places. They always should have been returned to a proper classified facility. And the president should be a little bit ashamed for that. But in terms of the substance of what these documents appeared to have been, particularly from his time as vice president, it appears to be things that he personally created, but then, you know, quite possibly not realizing the classification rules because he never worked in the executive branch as anything other than as vice president, he took them home with him. And at the time, he probably could because the government would have covered with proper facilities while he was vice president. But once that changed, it wasn't properly returned to storage the way it was supposed to be. It was things like a memo he authored for Barack Obama when Joe Biden was vice president and Obama was president. It was handwritten notes that Biden took based off classified documents. Those should never be removed from a classified storage facility. The fact they were is embarrassing.
He did tell a ghostwriter that he had just found all this classified stuff downstairs and that some of what he told him may be classified, so be careful. So does that show that he knew that he had classified documents?
So this got addressed a lot in the special counsel's report. The only evidence that Joe Biden was aware that documents he still had after leaving the vice presidency were classified and were in his personal possession are those eight words he uttered to the ghostwriter of, I just found some classified stuff in the attic or the basement, whatever it was. That's it. The special counsel could not find any other evidence from witnesses, from documentation, anything to corroborate the idea that Biden actually found something in 2017, that the documents were in fact classified, that they were in fact the same documents that were ultimately recovered. And so that became part of the problem was there was no meat on that bone. It could have been nothing more an erroneous comment by President Biden that was not actually based on actual classified documents. They couldn't find any proof to substantiate that remark. And in terms of what Joe Biden said to the ghostwriter about whether or not the information he was providing could be classified. The dirtiest but most openly known secret within the U.S. government is that when former government officials go and write their books, none of them write these things themselves. They all have ghostwriters. They all spill secrets to the ghostwriters. They're not supposed to do it, but everybody does this, and the U.S. government kind of says, we'll let you go with that so long as, you know, the books themselves ultimately get screened for classified information.
The conclusion was that Biden willfully retained and disclosed classified materials, but Herr couldn't prove that.
Correct. He couldn't prove that he had willfully done it in the sense that Biden was ever truly aware that there was classified documents still in his possession post-Obama administration. The only evidence were those eight words to the ghostwriter. There was no other evidence of it. And even if they could have proven that, and this is where the special counsel messed up the legal analysis, even if they could prove intent simply by the fact that the documents were there, the Espionage Act provision, which is the same one that's being used against Donald Trump, has an additional caveat. You have to also demonstrate a refusal by the individual to return the documents once confronted about it by the U.S. government. That obstructive act is what got Donald Trump in trouble, that he played games and tried to conceal things according to the indictment against him. That did not happen with Joe Biden. When he was confronted, they turned the documents over like they're supposed to. In those circumstances, the government virtually never pursues criminal charges.
And in fact, this hasn't gotten as much media attention as the characterization of Biden's memory, but the special counsel sets out the difference between Biden's case and Trump's case.
Yeah, and that was the one, I would say, silver lining to how the special counsel approached the report, was to make clear and delineate those distinctions. But by going into these other extraneous and irrelevant remarks about Biden's memory, which would have no bearing at all on the government's ability to prove their case, it inserted a political element to this report that was completely improper and just raised memories for so many of James Comey in July of 2016, making his irrelevant and extraneous remarks about Hillary Clinton. They couldn't bring charges, but they decided to launch a political attack.
Yeah, he said, we have also considered that at trial, Mr. Biden would likely present himself to a jury, as he did during our interview of him, as a sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with a poor memory. So, Brad, how many times have you heard witnesses in depositions say, I don't recall, I don't remember, or words to that effect?
More times than I can count, and I can remember Donald Trump doing it to Mr. Mueller in writing. Because remember, Trump never actually sat for a deposition. He submitted responses to written questions. He had, I do not recall, in there a bunch of times. Marjorie Taylor Greene on the stand in her disqualification trial constantly said, I do not recall. It is a common thing. People don't remember these kinds of details, especially years after the fact. But what was important from a legal standpoint, and this is again where the special counsel got it wrong, is that whether or not Biden could prove he had a poor memory would do nothing to save him as a legal matter in terms of criminal culpability. Putting aside that he would never testify, just as Donald Trump's not going to testify in any of his trials, it's entirely irrelevant to the government's case and their ability to demonstrate criminal culpability, the extent to which Joe Biden has a good memory in this context.
And, I mean, the Justice Department rules and the intent is that federal prosecutors should remain sensitive to the privacy and reputation interests of uncharged parties.
But yes, correct.
That's out the window here.
Yeah, that's out the window at this point. And this is, again, when I read this executive summary at the beginning, before we got to the bigger report, but when I read the executive summary and reading these extraneous remarks, I got to say before, it just brought back memories of July 2016, because this is stuff that you are not supposed to do at the Justice Department. You don't engage in these extraneous political attacks on someone you've decided not to charge. You know, Robert Mueller's report, for all its in-depth, details, didn't make those kind of political attacks on Donald Trump. It never went to that far because he wrote his in line with department procedures and policies. I do not believe Special Counsel Herr adhered to those practices.
And what could Garland have done? I mean, could he have released a summary like Bill Barr did with the Mueller report, or could he have requested that gratuitous information about Biden be edited out?
Yes, he could have done all those things. He could have done his own executive summary, just like Bill Barr did. He would have had complete authority to do it and discretion under the regulations. Merrick Garland is far more of an institutionalist than Bill Barr was, but certainly than Donald Trump was. And Merrick Garland said, transparency is the best avenue here. Just put it out. That was his choice. He's going to have to live with that in terms of the political ramifications.
I mean, does this point to, you know, the problem with special counsels? I mean, here he conducted 173 interviews, 147 witnesses, including Biden, collected millions of documents to compile the report. And there is enormous pressure for these special counsel to bring charges.
Yeah, and this is where we've unfortunately gotten to the point where the special counsel regulations have been corrupted the way the original independent counsel statute passed by Congress got corrupted. When you create independent positions, you give them these budgets, and you give them what is ultimately, in all these cases, a politically charged legal question, they feel it necessary to justify their work. The only person who got a very simple and sweet investigation was Mike Pence. And that's because there ultimately was no special counsel. It was handled by a U.S. attorney's office. But for Joe Biden, for Donald Trump, with the Durham investigation as well, in terms of Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration, it's always these special counsels now. Everything requires a special counsel. And inevitably, they seek to find a way to justify their expense. And they ultimately, in some cases, start bringing cases that don't succeed, particularly at trial. We saw that with Durham probe, two different not guilty verdicts at trial, and they couldn't prove their original premise. We saw that with Special Counsel Hurd, does all this stuff, declines to bring charges appropriately, in my view, against Joe Biden, but then writes this political charged summary. This is a problem we did not anticipate with the special counsel regulation.
And now I suppose the next question is going to be whether there will be a release of all or part of the questioning of Joe Biden by the special counsel. More to come. Thanks so much, Brad. That's Bradley Moss of Mark Zaid. In other legal news today, as expected, Donald Trump is asking the Supreme Court to keep his criminal trial for trying to overturn the 2020 election on hold while he appeals a ruling from the D.C. Circuit Court that rejected his bid for immunity from prosecution. Trump has asked the justices to give him the option of seeking review from an en banc panel of the D.C. Circuit, rather than appealing directly to the Supreme Court. Coming up next, in a defeat for UBS, the Supreme Court makes it easier for whistleblowers. This is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
In a win for whistleblowers and a loss for UBS, the Supreme Court has made it easier for whistleblowers to win suits claiming retaliation under a federal investor protection law. The justices reinstated a $900,000 jury verdict won by a fired UBS Group research strategist. In a unanimous decision, the justices found that a whistleblower is not required to make a showing that the employer acted with retaliatory intent. Why? Well, simply, that requirement doesn't square with the language of the 2002 Sarbanes-Oxley Act, as Justice Neil Gorsuch emphasized during oral arguments as he questioned UBS's attorney, Eugene Scalia, the son of the late Justice Antonin Scalia.
Whistleblower retaliation.
I just don't see those words in this statute. I see discrimination in this statute, and I see whistleblowing activity, and I know there's a causation requirement, but I don't see the retaliation in the statute.
Yeah.
So help me out. You're asking me to read things into a statute that aren't there, aren't you, counsel?
Joining me is John George Aris, a partner at Scorinci Hollenbeck. First, tell us about the facts of the case itself.
So we have an employee of UBS that was fired in connection with a complaint that he had made to HR regarding two UBS trading desk employees who were essentially pressuring him to put a slant on his reporting. This individual, the person that was terminated from UBS, was producing research reports, and it was a requirement under the Securities and Exchange Commission's framework that these reports be independent. So the individual here felt he was under pressure, made a complaint within UBS internally, and then shortly thereafter was terminated, which then led to the lawsuit under Sarbanes-Oxley for a claim that this was a retaliatory adverse employment action, which led us eventually to the Supreme Court.
So the jury ruled for him, but then the Second Circuit reversed. Explain why the Second Circuit reversed.
So the essential issue in this case is what a plaintiff has to prove versus what the defendant, UBS, would have to counter with. The reason the Second Circuit reversed the case is because at the district court level, the court did not instruct the jury that the plaintiff, the employee that was fired, was required to show that his employer acted with retaliatory intent. This was an element that the Second Circuit felt Congress had put into the law and that he was required as a plaintiff to prove that. By not giving the jury that instruction, the Second Circuit said that the district court had erred and then reversed the case on this basis of retaliatory intent being a key element of the claim, which then later brings us to the Supreme Court, where that issue was then litigated.
So was there a split in the circuits about whether you need retaliatory intent or not?
Exactly. And that's what led to the appeal to the Supreme Court. That decision created a split. And therefore, we needed clarity on the law for what a plaintiff was required to show in order to make this claim, a retaliatory employment claim.
All right. So what did the Supreme Court say?
The Supreme Court came down in a 9-0 unanimous decision ruling in favor of the plaintiff. And essentially the holding, it's very simple. The court held that this whistleblower, the employee, must prove that their activity was a contributing factor in the employee's unfavorable personnel action, but need not prove that the employer acted with retaliatory intent. So that's the key. The Supreme Court came back and said, retaliatory intent is not part of this. All you have to do is show as a plaintiff that the retaliatory action was in connection with the protected whistleblower activity. Here, it was raising the fact that he was put under pressure to produce reports that weren't independent. If the plaintiff is able to prove that retaliation at least was a part of the termination, then the burden shifts to the employer, in this regard to UBS, who then has to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that no, the report to HR, the whistleblowing act, had nothing to do with the retaliation. And specifically here, UBS stated the business had lost millions of dollars and that this employee was dispensable because the work that he was producing, these research reports, weren't necessary to UBS's business. That was their attempt to try to say it wasn't retaliatory. But that's the burden shifting mechanism. And the way the court came down at the end of the day is they eliminated this retaliatory intent portion of it, saying that it wasn't really part of Congress's intent, and it would undermine the burden-shifting framework of bringing a claim and then attempting to rebut it.
It seems like this really lowers the burden for plaintiffs in these kinds of cases. I mean, will it make it much easier for them to prove their case?
I believe that this would motivate individuals that were terminated after a whistleblower complaint to bring more claims, because this retaliatory intent in and of itself as an element is hard to get to because you're going to someone's mindset that may be very difficult to break down. So yes, I do think that ultimately the Supreme Court has opened the door to more of these cases, and there's still a burden. You still have to prove, at least by a preponderance of the evidence, that you were terminated at least in part as a result of your protected activity, making a claim to HR whistleblowing in some way, shape, or form. So it's still there. It's just not that extra step of retaliatory intent. So I would imagine that we will see an uptick in these types of cases.
And several business groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, had asked the Supreme Court to side with UBS. And this is a Supreme Court that is very much business-oriented. So was this a surprising decision?
It was somewhat of a surprising decision, especially that it came down 9-0 and it was drafted by Justice Sotomayor, the opinion. It is somewhat surprising that this is where they landed. But I think the Supreme Court has also stuck very closely to a textual interpretation of the statutes that they're analyzing. And here in the decision, the justices seem to all fall on the same side of essentially saying this law, the way it's written, Sarbanes-Oxley, the way that it's written, there's no reading into this of retaliatory intent being a clear element. Rather, the burden-shifting framework that they have for bringing a claim, proving that retaliation was a part of it, and then giving the defendant an opportunity to show that there were many other reasons why that individual was terminated is the proper sort of textual interpretation of this law. And that's where they ultimately came down. So, yes, I think it's somewhat surprising that they're so business oriented. But I think this court has also shown that they will take a look at a statute and not read anything else into it that wasn't explicitly outlined by Congress.
The Second Circuit, which is the circuit that handles so many securities cases and cases involving business, Wall Street, where did it come up with that standard if it's nowhere in the statute?
I think that it was a matter of time and litigation. Obviously, the jurisprudence was lending itself in that direction. And the act itself, you could read into it that the retaliatory intent and the retaliatory act, there's a pretty close nexus between the two that blended itself into jury instructions, that you have to show they had this type of intent, retaliatory intent, in order to have an adverse finding against them. What the court is saying here is just a little bit more nuanced. It's saying the plaintiff has to show that retaliation at least in part led to the decision to the employer terminating them. The retaliatory intent, I think, just became part of a jury instruction to sort of make that concept more clear. The Supreme Court felt, okay, this was a step too far. This is an intent that wasn't a part of the law.
So now employers will have to come up with proof that it wasn't retaliation.
Absolutely, and they will have to closely document it, especially in cases where there's a whistleblower. They will have to very closely document what occurred. And the key in these cases are the time period between when the whistleblower takes the action, right, to report that there was something untoward going on or that there were some issues happening at the company, and the time when they get terminated. The shorter that time period is, typically the harder it will be to prove as an employer that this action was taken independent of what the whistleblower's conduct was. The longer that time period, the more chance you have to build a record and closely document. But I'm sure that across Wall Street, all the major banks are now on notice that someone makes a whistleblower complaint and they end up, you're considering letting them go. You better very closely document the reasons why, because as you stated earlier, this was a fairly sizable verdict and award, and whistleblower actions happen quite often. The SEC has a robust whistleblowers program, and internally, all the banks are required to have some level of compliance and HR to allow people to have that outlet to sort of police themselves. So I imagine now, in light of this decision, the general counsel of banks are getting together and putting a framework in place for how they're going to now document even further than they've done before, employees that blow the whistle, they're going to be terminated. There has to be a process in place for what's going to happen, because they'll need to mitigate a lot of risk here, a lot of potential risk.
And do you think it might lead to more settlements as well?
Get a lot of inbound inquiries from individuals that were fired from brokerage firms, right? Fired from banks. And it kind of follows the same story. They reported something to HR, and then they're terminated not that long after. This case opens up the gates for me in a lot of ways. I mean, I'll be citing to this case in every demand letter I write to these big banks. It'll be one of the first things that I cite. Say, hey, if you want to litigate this, just so you're aware, you know, my burden just got a lot lower and your burden just got a lot higher. So why don't we have a conversation before we get to that point?
It's interesting to hear the real-world effect of these Supreme Court decisions. Thanks so much, John George. That's John George Aris of Skirinci Hollenbeck. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, we're going to talk to the principal architect of the SEC's whistleblower program. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by listening to our Bloomberg Law podcasts. You can find them wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
The Supreme Court has made it easier for whistleblowers to win suits claiming retaliation in a loss for UBS, reinstating a $900,000 jury verdict won by a fired research strategist. The justices, voting unanimously against UBS, said the Sarbanes-Oxley Act doesn't require whistleblowers to prove they were the victims of intentional retaliation. Joining me now is Sean McKessie. He was the first chief of the SEC Whistleblower Office and the principal architect of the Whistleblower Program. He's now a partner at Phillips & Cohen. Were you surprised that this business-friendly Supreme Court came down with this unanimous decision?
Yes, I was surprised. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this. We have now two whistleblower-related cases, both of which were decided unanimously. So it appears that somehow the Supreme Court is able to find common ground when it comes to whistleblower-related cases. So if you may remember in Digital Realty, the court ruled 9-0 that a person needs to report to the SEC to be protected under the anti-retaliation provisions of Dodd-Frank. And, you know, those of us on the whistleblower side, I think we're hopeful that there would be more fertile ground for understanding that whistleblowers should be protected when they report, quote unquote, only to their employers and not to the SEC. And most employers said they would prefer reporting internally and not, you know, quote unquote, running to the SEC. And that's basically where that court came down. And now fast forward a case under Sarbanes-Oxley, which preceded Dodd-Frank. Interestingly enough, retaliation is on the table again. And here, unanimously, the decision is made to favor whistleblowers in striking down a ruling that you need to prove that an employer intended to retaliate in order to succeed under a Sarbanes-Oxley retaliation claim. So you got two retaliation cases, one going for, you know, the corporate side, one going for the whistleblower side, both unanimous. And it is of interest in that, at least stereotypically, you think there's a certain sector of the court that is, quote unquote, more business friendly and might therefore be more antagonistic potentially to whistleblowers, and another faction that would be more favorable. And in two cases, they came down unanimously. And interestingly, one was very pro-whistleblower and one, in my view, was anti-whistleblower. But I think if you look at a strict reading of the statute, both of them in some ways almost had to be unanimous because you either read the statute one way or you read it the other. In both instances, they agreed on how to read, in this particular instance, Sarbanes-Oxley, and in the Digital Realty case, it was the Dodd-Frank statute. But, you know, ultimately a favorable development for those of us who represent whistleblowers.
How difficult is it for an employee to prove that an employer acted with retaliatory intent?
Retaliation cases, by their nature, are circumstantial. Very rarely do you have a smoking gun where somebody goes to an employee and says, we're firing you because you reported this wrongdoing, either internally or to the FEC. That is very, very rare. I say I've never seen it. And so you have to put together a case that shows, you know, chronology is usually the best way to put it. This employee had great reviews. Company finds out wrongdoing was reported. All of a sudden, the employee's reviews go down the tank, and conveniently, either the whistleblower is fired or marginalized or moved off of his or her primary responsibility. That in and of itself is a difficult case to put together. Imagine on top of that, you have to prove that the employer had a mental state of intentionality in order to succeed on retaliation. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I think it's really hard to read anybody's intention and prove anybody's intention. You know, I was thinking you just called me, and I would say you intentionally called me, and the evidence I have is that you picked up the phone and you called me. But if you came back to me and said, I'm sorry, that was a butt dial, I can't prove that you didn't intend to call me, because all I know is that you picked up the phone and now I'm talking to you. And, you know, it's a loose analogy, but imagine if you're an employee who has been fired and you have all the circumstance, great review, wrongdoing reported, fired. Okay, that's great, but can you prove that they intended to fire you for the reporting as opposed to something else? And there's always something else, right? Employers always come up with, you know, you were late with your timesheets, you pledged an expense account, or it's a RIF, you know, we're cutting down costs, and you're just one of four or five people getting fired. There's always something else that an employer can either turn to or in some instances fabricate, and I don't say that lightly, but it has happened that employers have come up with excuses for firing after the fact to fit the story. So a very favorable outcome in the UBS case, and interesting that all nine justices came down, you know, in a way that tips the scales in favor of whistleblowers under Sarbanes-Oxley. When under Dodd-Frank, they tip the scales in the opposite direction.
Even during the oral arguments, Justice Gorsuch said, I don't see retaliation in the statute. So is the difference that Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank have different language?
Yes. And the interesting thing for those of us on the side of whistleblowers is in Dodd-Frank, everybody knows, and this was the argument that was made that the court unanimously rejected because the language in the statute is very specific and defined a whistleblower as someone who reports wrongdoing to the commission. And later in the statute, it talks about all these enhanced protections for whistleblowers. And the whistleblower bar's view is that clearly Congress intended to enhance retaliation protections from Sarbanes-Oxley to Dodd-Frank. And one of the ways they did that was to have all these enhanced measures. You know, they increased the penalties from one-time back pay to 2.5 back pay. They increased the statute of limitations in Dodd-Frank. Ultimately, all of that got stripped away because in the definition section, it said a person retaliates only if they report wrongdoing to the commission. And by a 9-0 vote, the commission said that language in and of itself drives the decision. Sarbanes-Oxley is a little bit less direct in terms of how it defines retaliation and how do you perfect your status. And it doesn't have specific language about needing to report something to a specific entity to be entitled to these protections. It's more a directive to employers as opposed to a definition of employee. And it says in Sarbanes-Oxley, no person shall take any action to discriminate against someone who reports wrongdoing. So in that way, it's prescriptive in some ways. Whereas in Dodd-Frank, it was pointed to the whistleblower and says, if you want to be a whistleblower, you have to do the following things, one of which is report to the SEC. And so that distinction allows Sarbanes-Oxley to be a little bit more fluid in how it determines the pool of people who are entitled to retaliation protection. And, you know, in the particular case that the circuit court found, you may have provided evidence that you were retaliated against, but you fall short in that you cannot prove that there was intentionality behind the conduct, that they intentionally wanted to retaliate against you, as opposed to a more easy standard to meet, which is it was one of the contributing factors. You know, as I said, there's always going to be a number of reasons that an employer can point to as to why a certain action was taken vis-a-vis an employee. But if you add an evidential burden that you have to prove that the employer intended to make you feel like you retaliated against, that enhances the burden. As I was thinking about this, it would almost completely declaw the retaliation protections of Sarbanes-Oxley, because the burden to prove what was in somebody's head when they took a certain action is virtually impossible to meet absent a specific recorded phone call or email, and most sophisticated of people in the corporate bar know not to put these things in writing in such a way that says, you know, we're firing you because we're really mad that you reported this wrongdoing. That would basically be the only paradigm for a retaliation case if the circuit court's opinion was adopted. And to their credit, unanimously, the Supreme Court rejected that and said Sarbanes-Oxley wasn't intended to be so strictly defined. And it's prescriptive to employers, you shall not take any action because somebody reported wrongdoing without putting in an intentionality requirement that the circuit court superimposed into it.
Several business groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, had argued that establishing a lower bar for employees would lead to employers being hit with a lot more meritless claims.
Yeah, a common refrain, and I guess I should backtrack for a second. I worked for three different companies between my stints at the SEC, so I'm not anti-corporate America, and I understand, certain perspectives that are brought in, but it's very commonly complained about that, anytime the SEC tries to put in protections for whistleblowers or, in the case of Dodd-Frank, build an incentive program to incentivize people to come forward, the common refrain is, and we certainly heard this when in 2011 we were putting together the rules for the new whistleblower program under Dodd-Frank, we got a lot of comments like, you don't know what you're asking for, SEC, you're going to be inundated with a lot of nonsense, HR complaints, my boss is a jerk, and it would basically overwhelm the SEC intake system. And, I think the SEC was thoughtful about that and tried to put in rules. You have to sign the TCR under penalty of perjury, and it has aspects of if you're doing this in bad faith, you could put yourself in jeopardy. And I think what we found, at least, certainly in my 5.5 years running the whistleblower program at the SEC, we were not overwhelmed with nonsense. There was a lot of very valuable information brought to us about retaliation cases, and the SEC has availed itself of its new retaliation jurisdiction to, penalize companies for retaliation. But I don't think anybody, including the chamber, would argue that it has been an overwhelming landslide of retaliation cases, and the SEC has eagerly, jumped in on what at base was a disagreement between an employer and employee. They've only taken action for retaliation when it was clear via the timeline and via other circumstances that a person who was doing a fine job, as far as he or she knew, it comes to the employer's attention that wrongdoing is being investigated, and all of a sudden really bad things start to happen. But those are the kinds of cases that you see that the SEC has brought. And so I know and I understand that the knee-jerk reaction whenever a pro-whistleblower rule, statute, the Supreme Court ruling comes down is, oh boy, this is going to create, a whole groundswell of bad outcomes, and the SEC will be overwhelmed. They already have limited resources, and they're not going to be able to handle all the nonsense they're going to get. When in fact, I don't know that there's any empirical data that backs it up. I think a lot of gnashing of teeth often happens in the hypothetical. And then when you say, okay, show me an example, people are hard-pressed to come with a definitive example of that actually happening. So while I'm sympathetic and I understand uncertainty is an unhappy development for in-house counsel and people who represent companies, everyone loves to have a black and white, if you do this, you'll stay on the right side of the law. If you do that, you'll be on the wrong side. But, that's not the way the legal process works. It's certainly not the way compliance works. There are always going to be elements of gray. And, I think the SEC has a track record of not jumping into the gray on the wrong side to invite all kinds of nonsensical retaliation claims that they take up and advocate on behalf of the whistleblower. I think you have to look at the data. Don't look at the complaints or the worry. Look at what actually happened. And I think if you compare those, all of the doomsday scenarios that even the whistleblower program, there was a lot of apocalyptic language about this is going to destroy internal compliance and everyone's going to run to the SEC and no one's going to be loyal to their companies. We're 11, 12 years in and the data doesn't support all of that doomsday rhetoric. And I think it's similar to what was being argued in connection to Sarbanes-Oxley decision.
It's great to see this from the perspective of the SEC whistleblower program. Thanks so much, Sean. That's Sean McKessie, a partner at Phillips & Cohen. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.